Another study found that milkweed oil is high in vitamin E and is free from the toxins found in other parts of the plant. The oil from milkweed can also make an ideal ingredient for moisturizers, cosmetics, or even biodiesel fuel.
Wow, Don. I guess one man's weed is another man's treasure.
This moment of science comes from Indiana University, with production support from the American Society of Plant Biologists.
Today's program was prepared by Sue Ann Zollinger, with help from Thomas Marr at the University of St. Andrews, Scotland. I'm Yael Cassander.
And I'm Don Glass.
In sports, the Chicago Cubs bats are hot at Wrigley Field this afternoon. In the bottom of the fourth, the Cubs lead the Houston Astros 9-0. Tonight's Cardinals-Dodgers game in St. Louis is a battle of division leaders. The Cardinals moved back on top of the National League Central with a win last night. The Chicago White Sox try to avoid being swept by Minnesota as the two teams wrap up a series tonight in Minneapolis. The Sox have lost 16 of the last 20 against the Twins at the Metrodome. Just days before the start of Minnesota's training camp, Brett Favre has informed the Vikings he will not come out of retirement for a second time to play for them this season. The 39-year-old three-time NFL MVP turns 40 in October. Michael Phelps bounced back from a stunning loss to set a world record in the 200-meter butterfly at the World Swimming Championships one night after he was soundly beaten by Germany's Paul Biedermann in the 200 freestyle. Phelps got back on track today with a time of 1:51.51, more than a half second ahead of his previous mark. In the very next event, Italy's Federica Pellegrini had the home crowd roaring even louder when she set another world record, the 20th of the championships. Pellegrini won the 200 freestyle in 1:52.98, beating her mark from the semifinals a day earlier. That's sports.
Programs on WILL AM are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting audiences to enjoy Krannert Uncorked, a weekly wine tasting almost every Thursday at 5 p.m. in the lobby. More information is at krannertcenter.com.
One of Great Britain's great institutions is under economic threat. The British Beer and Pub Association says an average of 52 pubs are closing each week. Some people blame tough times and changing times. As Vicky Barker reports from London, some are also blaming the government.
Hello, how are you guys?
On a quiet, drizzly afternoon, Mike Franklin, manager of the Cross Keys pub, greets his customers by name, all three of them. Jerry Wright is perched on his usual stool, a pint glass of lager at his elbow.
I've been drinking here for 30 years. Everybody's friendly. Everybody knows everybody else. It's a real, like, British pub. It's how it should be.
But business at the Cross Keys is largely confined to weekends now. Mike Franklin says the days of locals crowding in for a beer and a chat most evenings are pretty much over.
Before, people would go out for a pint, maybe on a Tuesday, play darts, on a Wednesday after football, because beer was cheap enough commodity at the time, and on the weekends they'd always go out. These days, beer's a lot more expensive, and people are put off by that.
Changing consumer tastes, a two-year-old smoking ban, and deepening recession have hit pubs hard. But for thousands, the death blow's been dealt by rising government taxes on beer, up 20% in the past 2 years. The traditional pint glass of beer now runs about $6. Few working-class Brits now can afford that other British tradition, buying your friends a round.
This is a keg. The beer that's inside the keg is filtered, it's pasteurized, and it's under pressure.
Fuller's Brewery, a mile down the road. Tony Johnson of Fuller's says there's been a brewery around here since Elizabethan times.
On the other side of the cellar, you'll see a row of casks. These are also called firkins. These are 9-gallon firkins. The next one up from those is a Kilderkin, which is 18 gallons.
As a supplier, Fuller says it's holding its own in the recession because increased supermarket sales are almost filling the gap left by the failing pubs. But that fact tells a story, too. The big supermarket chains are able to undercut pub prices, so thousands of customers are deserting the ever more expensive pubs to drink the cheaper beer at home, alone.
There is no alternative to the pub.
Fuller's chairman, Michael Turner, is also head of the British Beer and Pub Association. He understands not just the economic cost, but the social cost of a failing pub, especially in the countryside.
It is the centre of the community, and all the social interaction that goes with a pub is likely to be lost when the pub goes. I mean, you can go from three pubs to two pubs in a community, but when you lose the last pub, that's it.
If you want to take a seat, I'll bring it over to you.
For many, it's down to this, adapt or die. Carl Faulkner is assistant manager of the Black Lion Pub in West London, where you can play bingo some nights or even have your fortune told.
We have psychic nights, which are like really very popular. Or Moroccan nights we do with like Moroccan food and belly dancers and all that. So.
Staff at the Black Lion don't just dispense beer, they deliver an experience.
Films we show in the winter. Yeah, we do all sorts. Anything to get them in, really.
The formula's working. That and a menu strategically placed several notches above ordinary pub grub, but priced well below the gourmet fare available at so-called gastro pubs.
You have to concentrate on the food, because if you don't sell the beer, do you know what I mean? There's a lot more profit in food there is as well, so...
Prime Minister Gordon Brown has refused to reconsider further rises in the tax on beer. Industry leaders say that means thousands more pubs will die. For NPR News, I'm Vicky Barker in London.
Green roofs are increasing in popularity across the U.S., especially in cities where there's not a lot of space for gardens. Sabri Benashour explores the trend in Washington, D.C., where the city government is promoting the practice for its environmental benefits.
In Washington, you can see flowers and vegetables growing on top of homes, businesses, even government buildings throughout the city. D.C. officials say Washington has nearly 70,000 square feet of rooftop greenery. Only Chicago has more. One big fan of these so-called green roofs is a popular small hotel, the Tabard Inn, just a few blocks from the White House.
There's about 10 varieties of sedums on this roof.
Sarah Murphy is giving a tour. She's a horticulturist.
And this is a very pungent oregano right here on the corner that's doing really well. It looks actually like it's been heavily used.
The city of Washington pays building owners about a fourth the cost of incorporating greenery onto rooftops. One big reason? Rainwater runoff. Sarah Loveland works for an environmental consulting nonprofit called DC Greenworks. She says Washington has what's called a combined sewer system. The sewers don't just take in what's flushed down the drain, but also all the rain running off roofs and streets.
If you imagine that our sewage treatment plant, it has a dam, and the sewage system combines with the stormwater system before the treatment plant.
So when there's a heavy rain, that dam at the sewage treatment plant overflows.
You have both raw sewage and runoff from the streets coming directly into the river untreated.
3 billion gallons of it a year at one point. The EPA sued the District of Columbia. The city had to spend $150 million to address the problem. Part of that money goes to green roof grants. The green roofs slow down rainwater, give it some place to soak instead of just running off straight down the gutter. The city says its green roofs prevent 1 million gallons of stormwater runoff from entering the Potomac River. The roofs also insulate buildings, especially during the summer. Some studies show they reduce energy costs by 20% to 30%, and they reduce the heat island effect in the city since they don't get blisteringly hot like traditional roofs. Green roofs even offer some habitat for creatures like bees. Sarah Loveland with DC Greenworks, the environmental nonprofit, says rooftop gardens are increasingly popular for growing food.
Veggies are really popular. Herbs are really popular. This is a trend that we're starting to see take off in the restaurant industry, and there's just been a lot of buzz developing about it.
Blueberry bushes and herbs sprawl over the rooftop gardens of the Tabard Inn, where Paul Pell is executive chef.
And we can go up and get whatever we want, so it's fresh. We just climb out the window when we need it, get what we need. Chocolate basil goes in ice cream. Nasturtium is for garnishes for soups or salad.
Washington has an advantage over some larger cities in its promotion of rooftop gardens because federal law prohibits skyscrapers in the nation's capital. So most buildings don't cast shadows over their neighbors. As a result, most rooftops are sunny. All they need is greenery to soak up the rays. For the Environment Report, I'm Sabri Benashour.
The Tour de France wrapped up this past weekend with Spain's Alberto Contador the winner. Contador's victory means Spanish cyclists have won the Tour for the last 4 years. And although cycling is a sport, it is extremely popular in Spain, there's a contradiction here. Hardly anyone in Spain uses a bicycle to go to work or run errands or just to go for a spin. That's what Jerome Sokolowski found when he went out with his kids.
We're on our bikes this morning, like every morning, and we're going to take my eldest son to his swimming class at the municipal pool. Watch out for this car, Menda, that's backing up. And we've just arrived at the pool. This is where we lock up our bikes. And our bikes are the only ones here.
Papa, take off your helmet, Papa.
Yeah, I'll take off my helmet.
Whenever I ride with my kids in Spain, people look at us like we're from another planet. According to the European Union, the average Spaniard bikes just 12 miles a year, compared to between 500 and 600 miles for the average Dutchman or Dane. Even the car-loving Germans can manage almost 200 miles a year. But paradoxically, Spain has the perfect climate for biking. It's a favorite training ground for the world's competitive cyclists, including Lance Armstrong, who lived here for several years. You'd be hard-pressed to find another country where the people who cycle as a sport are so obsessive about it. Every weekend, the roads outside Madrid are crowded with cyclists clad in their flashy, skin-tight suits.
So, here I am on my old mountain bike, and I'm trying to catch up to one of the cyclists on this very steep road, as you can hear. Hola, buenos días.
28-year-old Tomás Hernán says he and his friends are drawn to cycling by the love of the outdoors. It helps you keep in shape, escape the monotony of the city, and enjoy the views, he says. But pressed on why there's very little casual cycling in Spain, 51-year-old Francisco Ayón says you have to be crazy to get on a bike in most Spanish cities. Look at our culture, he says, as he points to the cars and motorcycles racing by. Everyone's in a rush. We cyclists are just in the way. This is a country that jumped from poverty into headlong economic development in the late 80s and 90s. Spain's newly built infrastructure, combined with a passion for sport, is finally paying off in international medals. But many Spaniards look down on using a bicycle for transport the same way they would see riding a donkey. The parking garage of a new suburban shopping mall is full of latest model cars. Almudena Moreno says she doesn't even have a bike.
Muchas cuestas, mucho calor.
It's too hilly and too hot, she says. Because we have cars, we're very lazy, says high school student Rebecca Sanchez. It seems that even the successes of Alberto Contador and his countrymen in the Tour de France won't get more Spaniards biking with their kids to the pool. For NPR News, I'm Jerome Sokolowski in Madrid.
Whenever solar power is mentioned, critics are quick to note when there's no sun, there's no power. Lester Graham, though, talked with the author of a report who says there is a type of solar power that can store energy.
Concentrating solar thermal, or CST, can store power. Basically, mirrors are used to concentrate solar rays, heat up water, generate power. The heated water can be stored as heat in tanks like coffee in a thermos and produce electricity when needed. Brit Staley is with the World Resources Institute. She's the lead author of a new report on concentrating solar thermal. So you found if it's done right, CST could be built instead of coal-burning power plants. How practical is that?
We think that concentrating solar thermal is a very exciting renewable energy technology precisely because of this potential for storage. If you incorporate thermal energy storage or fossil fuel backup with your concentrating solar thermal, you can actually use the power of the sun around the clock.
Now, the CST plants are expensive. They're more expensive than building a coal-burning power plant. So why build them if that's the case?
With climate change as a major concern in the U.S. and around the world, we are going to need to reduce our dependency on coal in the power sector. And currently, as you said, concentrating solar thermal power is more expensive than coal, but in this report, we've identified several policy interventions that could help reduce costs. For example, a price on carbon, such as the cap-and-trade mechanism in current Waxman-Markey bill, and then some solar-specific policy interventions would help as well.
Now, when you say policy interventions, really you're talking about government subsidies, right?
Yes, support for R&D, for deployment such as the investment tax credit that's currently in place.
Obviously, the most sunny places would be the best location for a concentrating solar thermal plant.
Mm-hmm.
And the most sunny places are often in arid places, such as the U.S. Southwest. So they're the driest places, and CST relies heavily on water. So in the long term, what's the solution?
There are several alternative cooling technologies that are available and that can cut water by up to 95 to 98% in places where that is a concern.
Is this completely experimental, or have we seen this done anywhere in the world successfully?
It's absolutely been done successfully. And here in the U.S., we have some of the longest operating CST plants. And Spain is another good example of where CST deployment has been particularly successful to date.
How long would it take to build one of these, and how soon could they contribute, and how likely is it to happen given the cost?
A lot of the plants that we see on the drawing board right now are expected to be in operation in the next 2 to 5 years. With climate change concerns, with climate change legislation working its way through the House and Senate, coal plant investments are not particularly attractive right now, and investors are very wary of putting their money into something that's going to be significantly more expensive in the coming years. Concentrating solar thermal, on the other hand, is a zero emissions power resource. Also, it has zero fuel costs.
Britt Staley is the lead author of a report on concentrating solar thermal power plants. She's an associate researcher with the World Resources Institute's climate policy team. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
I'm Lester Graham.
Earth and Sky.
Wednesday, July 29th, 2009. Every year, people look forward to the Perseid meteor shower. But this year, the moon is destined to interfere with the peak of the shower, which comes on August 12th.
And that fact makes the next few days, in the hours before dawn, the best time in 2009 to watch meteors from Earth's northern hemisphere. Watch in a dark sky just before dawn begins.
There are two reasons why the next few pre-dawns will be so good for meteors. First, the Perseid meteor shower is rising to its peak now. You won't see as many meteors as on a moonless night during the peak, but with the moon gone from the sky in the hours before dawn now, we have a window for meteor watching.
Second, there's another meteor shower going on around now, too. The Delta Aquaridge shower doesn't have as definite a peak as the Perseids, but this shower is now producing a steady supply of meteors, which you can see in dark skies.
A third reason we in the Northern Hemisphere like our late July and August meteors is simply the weather. Nights are warm now, and it's a great time to go to a dark location for a night-long look at the heavens.
All you really need to watch meteors is a dark, open sky. You might expect to see several meteors every hour. And for today, that's our show. I'm Joel Block.
And I'm Deborah Bird. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.